The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start with the cover story, the headline, Unlocking Raleigh's New Front Door, Union Station. The platform at the downtown Raleigh train depot isn't much more than a strip of crumbling pavement. Inside the 70-year-old station, the waiting area is small and often crowded, and the only food option is an aging vending machine. For a city that's pitching itself to Amazon and views itself as a cutting-edge place for tech and life sciences companies, the train station is a relic of another era. Or, as urban designer Roberta Fox of the city of Raleigh says, it's just very small town and old-timey. But not for much longer. Just up the tracks, the city's gleaming new Union Station will open this spring, after 2 years of construction and many more years of hashing out designs. Some critics have called the station a vanity project. The first phase will cost nearly $90 million, more than half of it from federal grants. And while the facility could serve as a new gathering point downtown, with office and retail space, a rooftop restaurant, and a public plaza, the only initial improvement to the Triangle's transportation system will be two more tracks and a few more trains. But the people behind the project say the station is about much more than updating the old train platform. To some, it's about transforming downtown Raleigh and perhaps the city itself. Future phases will make space for a large bus station, commuter rail connecting Raleigh to other cities in the Triangle, and perhaps, far off in the future, high-speed trains zipping up and down the East Coast. For Raleigh to compete nationally and even globally, this kind of transformation is necessary, supporters say. If we wanted to be a world-class city, we had to provide that world-class front door, Fox says. And for now, the business community has bought in, investing hundreds of millions of dollars in the surrounding blocks, with projects large and small that show confidence in the changes ahead. Big City Dreams. On a recent tour of the Union Station construction site, architect Steve Schuster walks briskly through its dusty interior in jeans and tennis shoes. His firm, Clearscapes, designed the station, and Schuster also lives just across the street in a renovated warehouse he and his wife bought in 1987. He literally has watched the station's progress from his bedroom window. Standing in the middle of the station's main atrium, Schuster points to the rusting steel beams that hold the cavernous bulk of the station aloft. 80 years ago, these same beams were installed to build the Dillon Supply Viaduct Warehouse, but the building had been empty since 2005. Schuster and his team decided to leave them in place, he says, to use the skeleton of the old building to erect the new. Our job was to not screw it up, to let it be the industrial cathedral it was meant to be, he says. A tour of the humming construction site is filled with similarly grandiose descriptions and visions of the station's future. In a far corner, about halfway up a staircase, Schuster envisions a bride someday throwing a bouquet of flowers to a crowd of wedding guests below. The space was built to host events for which the city will collect revenue. Upstairs, a room encased in glass provides views down into the atrium and to the east the full breadth of the city's skyline. Someday in the not-so-distant future, Schuster insists the space will be home to the city's hottest new bar. Overall, the 26,000-square-foot building also includes 6,262 square feet of office space upstairs, and space at Union Station is expensive with a starting asking price of $30 per square foot, on par with top prices for commercial real estate in the market. John Kuntz of York Property Management, the company hired to manage the station's commercial spaces, predicts a tech company will fill the suite in the near future. In the retail space in the plaza below, he envisions vendors selling popcorn and coffee. For Schuster, all of this is much bigger than just longer train platforms. What projects like this do often is they change perception, he says. Not long ago, talk of a station in the once dilapidated warehouse district seemed like an outlandish dream. Two iterations of plans for the station never got off the ground in the 1990s and early 2000s. It wasn't until Mitch Silver moved to the city in 2005 as planning director that talks took a serious turn. As a native of New York City, where he currently serves as commissioner of the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation, Silver knew the importance of transit and train service to urban living. Shortly after arriving in town, he began eyeing the rundown buildings near the train tracks. There was nothing going on in the Warehouse District, Silver says. Land values were low and development potential was ripe. There were some historic buildings, but there were also incredible development sites that would let you go vertical, Silver says. After drafting plans for the station at its new location, the city received a major breakthrough in June 2012 when the federal government awarded Raleigh $21 million for the project in the form of a Tiger Grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation. Funding had been the major obstacle in the past, according to former Raleigh Mayor Charles Meeker. All that changed with the grant. Once the federal funds came in, then it was a real project, Meeker says. Fox, the lead planner on the development, remembers getting a call from Silver when news of the funding arrived. That was the largest grant that the city had ever received at the time, she says. That was the big deal moment. By 2015, when the city held an official groundbreaking ceremony for the project, work had already begun on several other large projects in the neighborhood, showing Silver's hopes for the station and the neighborhood might come true. Igniting development. Just across the street from Union Station, towering 18 stories above the sidewalk, stands The Dillon, a massive mixed-use building being developed by Kane Realty Corporation. It's one of several projects that have sprouted in the Warehouse District since the city secured funding for Union Station in 2012. Schuster and other advocates of the train station say the sizable public investment in the heart of the Warehouse District has helped spur development in the neighborhood, and they point to The Dillon as a prime example. Kane's group purchased the 2.5 acres of property for $13.9 million in 2015. Kane would not have done that if the city hadn't done this, Schuster says. People within Kane Realty use more tempered language when describing the role Union Station played in their business decisions, but they acknowledge the link. Having a significant investment of dollars next door to us was a very key factor to invest in the Warehouse District, says Mike Smith, president and chief operating officer of Kane Realty. The idea is the new station will make this part of downtown more convenient for visitors, commuters, and shoppers, and in turn, create a more enticing development environment, and the added density from new development increases ridership at the station. These are the concepts behind what planners call transit-oriented development, and they are all at play with Union Station. Sweetening the pot further is the city's development of the nearby Dorothea Dix Park, which the city acquired in 2015 for $52 million. Around the Warehouse District and surrounding neighborhoods, developers are taking note, and numerous buildings have sprung up or been proposed in the wake of Union Station. A few blocks west, at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Hillsborough Street, Maryland developer Heritage Properties is pumping $86 million into a 10-story office building called One Glenwood. The city's commitment to the train station was critical to making that happen, says Ryan Blair, Vice President of Development and Acquisitions at Heritage. Union Station in general played a big role in us deciding the location for One Glenwood, Blair says. It symbolizes the transition between the old downtown of Fayetteville Street into the newer downtown of Glenwood South and the Warehouse District. Some people say it's changing the core of downtown. This is happening on both sides of Union Station. To the east, on North Dawson Street, the Lundy Group is spending $160 million to build a 20-story office tower and a 20-story residential, retail, and hotel building. A block north, Greg Sandruder is in the midst of pre-leasing for a 20-story multifamily and retail building called 400 H. Total investment in the project is estimated at $125 million. Sandruder says the station wasn't critical to his business decisions with 400 H. While it wasn't a major factor, it was very nice icing on the cake, he says. Smaller projects are also evidence of the forces moving in the neighborhood. In a small building next to the station, Gabby and Rob Franz, the latter a former brewer at Trophy Brewing Company, plan to open an event space and bar this year. Lee Norris, who along with Frank Thompson is developing the 5-story, 45-unit Fairweather project just south of the station, says it's the transportation alternatives it will provide that make the area attractive for developers. These services are vital not only to increase demand for surrounding development, which we are witnessing, but also for the Raleigh brand attraction, he said in an email. But regardless of the exact effect of the station, it's clear that Silver's vision for the area is taking shape. The total private investment in the block surrounding Union Station already exceeds well over $500 million since the 2012 federal grant made the project feasible, and more projects are on the way. But at the end of the day, Raleigh's new station has to move people, and unlike other cities with multimodal stations, Raleigh's Union Station won't have commuter rail or transit facilities once it comes online, at least not right away. And we'll stop there as the article continues to mention the benefits of different modes of transportation in Raleigh. And then it ends with a couple of paragraphs. Combine the various transportation options and new development could change the way people move around Raleigh while also creating a new downtown. To Silver, the former planning director, the sum total of the parts will be a new front door to Raleigh. This is not just about transit, Silver says. This is now about creating a 21st century city and having a downtown that will grow and that we can be proud of. And now we turn to Biz, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The headline, UNC bets on revenue spike with stadium changes. On the day of college football's national championship game, UNC Chapel Hill announced it was adding seats back in Keenan Stadium and slashing capacity. Keenan seating will drop from 63,000 to 51,000, exactly half the capacity of the University of Alabama Stadium. So Biz wondered, what in the name of choo-choo justice is going on? Turns out that's what Carolina fans wanted, and UNC officials believe that adding seats back, along with changing how tickets are allotted, will improve the stadium experience and ultimately drive revenue. Keenan Stadium, which opened in 1927, is a gorgeous setting, but the game day experience at UNC has some disadvantages, and not just because the team doesn't play much defense. Parking is difficult, so the school lacks the tailgating experience of an Ole Miss or NC State, and Keenan's seats are basically bleachers, all of which was fine when the Tar Heel fans were watching Justice run wild in 1949, but is not as desired by modern fans. Rick Steinbacher, UNC's Senior Associate Athletic Director for External Communications, says the school has surveyed fans for feedback. Seat comfort, he says, was a top concern, so the school pulled out some bleacher seating last year and put in 1,600 seats with backs as a test. The feedback was overwhelmingly positive, Steinbacher says. It was amazing how many comments we got. We didn't go into it thinking we would do the whole stadium, but once we saw how positive the reviews were, that's what we decided to do. The student section will remain bleachers, and the Blue Zone already has chairbacks, but UNC will spend about $6 million to put in roughly 34,000 seats with backs. The timing is significant, too. Steinbacher said UNC changes its seat assignments for fans every 3 years, and selection is based on points with the Rams Club, the booster organization. 2018 will mark the start of the next three-year cycle, and Carolina is going to change the process for seat selection. Keenan Stadium will be divided into five zones, with ticket prices ranging from $375 per season ticket for Zone 1 to $150 for Zone 5. UNC officials crunched data on attendance and even got StubHub data to decide which zones were the most desirable. The move is going to cause some upheaval among fans, as each section at Keenan will lose some capacity. Every section is going to change, Steinbacher says. There are going to be fewer seats. We look at that as a positive. We heard loud and clear that the seats were not comfortable enough and we needed to upgrade them. So people are going to move, but they're going to get a better seat where they move to. How much revenue football brings in depends on how many home games and neutral site games the Tar Heels have. Some years, for example, UNC has 7 home games. In 2017, he says UNC had $12 million in revenue from football ticket sales, and the program brought in $40 million overall. Steinbacher expects that revenue to drop in 2018 with only 6 home games, but that over time, the appeal of seatbacks and varied price points will attract fans. We do think those changes over the long term will improve revenue out of football, he says. It won't be immediate. 20 years and counting for Triangle Sports talk host. Broadcasting can be a tough business with audience tastes and formats changing and evolving over time. So Adam Gold of 99.9 The Fan is hitting a significant milestone this month as he celebrates 20 years as a sports radio broadcaster in the market. The station is holding an on-air roast for Gold on January 17 from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Gold and Joe Ovies have established 99.9 The Fan as a significant presence and even lead the ratings for their time slot among men. Nielsen ratings for 2017 detail that their show drew a 10.3 rating among men aged 18 to 49, their target demographic. Public radio station WUNC was second in that male demo at 8.7 and 96.1 BBB Curtis Media, third at 8.3. WCMC, The Fan's call letters, had struggled as a country music format before pivoting in 2007 as Capital Broadcasting created a television, radio, and online sports operation. Campbell's Law Program adds student diversity. Pursuing a law degree is a full-time commitment, but for busy professionals in the Triangle, Campbell Law School offers a way to schedule that commitment so that it's indeed possible to achieve, even for a local police officer. I could not go to law school if it wasn't for the Campbell Flex program, says Raleigh Police Captain Timothy Tomczak. The program, which has included about 50 students, was a result of repeated requests to Campbell Law Dean Richard Leonard, who says people kept asking for flexibility. It takes at least 4 years to complete law school through the Flex program. The first year of law school is divided into two halves, one taken the first year in the Flex program and the other taken the second year. After that, students finish at their own pace, taking as few as 5 hours or finishing full time. Another auto plant miss for North Carolina recruiters. North Carolina swung and missed again in chasing an automotive plant. Alabama officials announced January 10 that the $1.6 billion Toyota Mazda plant is landing in North Alabama. The state already has Mercedes-Benz near Tuscaloosa, Hyundai outside Montgomery, and Honda in Lincoln. North Carolina Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland says the state offered an incentive package worth more than $1.5 billion, but Alabama's advantage with a built-in supply chain prevailed. The one hurdle that's been a constant, something we've had to deal with, was regarding the supply chain, Copeland said. We knew this all along. Alabama already has 3 auto plants scattered across the state, and other auto plants are in nearby states as well. That creates a corridor, as Copeland puts it, of companies serving that specific industry. At the end of the day, he said that accessibility outweighed us getting it. North Carolina is the only southeastern state with no auto plant. Visitors still flock to Tryon Palace in New Bern. Colonial Williamsburg has seen declining attendance in recent years, even slashing jobs to cut debt. So Biz took note when the North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources named William McCrea the executive director of Tryon Palace after he had served as interim since March. Tryon Palace and the historic buildings around it are a key source of tourism in eastern North Carolina. So far, interest in visiting the site remains strong, according to NCDNCR figures. Attendance for the 2015 to 2016 fiscal year was 241,961, up roughly 100,000 visitors from 6 years prior. The 2016 to 2017 fiscal year saw a slight dip to 223,537, but due mostly to Hurricane Matthew. And now we'll read a couple of articles related to things we've already read about. First, an article for another perspective from Birmingham Business Journal's Tyler Patchen. The headline, Here's Why Toyota Mazda Picked Alabama Over North Carolina. From the moment Toyota and Mazda announced plans for a joint manufacturing plant in the U.S., the project was coveted by a number of states. But ultimately, it was Alabama that rose to the top, with the company choosing a site west of Huntsville for the $1.6 billion project that is expected to employ 4,000 people. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey confirmed the project Wednesday afternoon during a news conference. Site selection experts told the Birmingham Business Journal there were a number of advantages and factors that may have led the auto giants to choose the state. One of those reasons was Alabama's history in the automotive world, with Huntsville already being home to a Toyota engine plant as well as assembly plants for Mercedes, Honda, and Hyundai. Those operations created a major supply chain in the state, with vendors and suppliers dotting counties across Alabama, including in the Tennessee Valley region, which is a hotbed of automotive activity. North Carolina, the other finalists, didn't have that same concentration of infrastructure or suppliers. John Boyd, founder of the Boyd Group, said that infrastructure and background in the industry was a benefit to Alabama. I think ultimately Toyota and Mazda didn't want to be pioneers. They didn't want to be the first auto manufacturer in North Carolina, said Boyd. He said Toyota's familiarity with Huntsville and its leadership is another factor that likely tipped the scales in Alabama's favor. The company's engine operations in Huntsville have been expanded multiple times, and the company has invested heavily in that plant, working closely with local officials along the way. On the logistics front, Alabama also has a well-established rail and port network, with its recently expanded Port of Alabama giving it strong access to Asia through the Panama Canal. Boyd said the University of Alabama in Huntsville and the strong pool of tech and engineering talent in North Alabama is another factor that shouldn't be overlooked, especially with the expected focus on electric vehicles in the future. Obviously, North Carolina's cluster of major research universities was a huge plus, so having an entity like UAH in the immediate vicinity was important. And we'll stop reading there as the article goes on to discuss how Huntsville is the economy of the future. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Union Station Could Be the Front Door to Raleigh. We're just a couple of months away from launching Raleigh's newest infrastructure project, Union Station. Developed over several phases, the project is expected to house Amtrak trains, GO Triangle buses, and eventually regional light rail. So far, $90 million of public money has been spent on Union Station. And what we will have for now is a spanking new rail station with two tracks instead of one, and an advanced plan to house the local buses. As our cover story points out, proponents of such a transportation terminal argue that this is much more than transit. Union Station will be the front door to the city. Perhaps, but not in its current state. According to the North Carolina Department of Transportation, about 150,000 riders use the Raleigh station every year, and that could reach 250,000 in 10 years. So on average, little more than 400 people use the Raleigh station to board or disembark every day from the 8 Amtrak stops, 4 inbound and 4 outbound trains. That's an average of about 50 people per train using Raleigh as a station. Even if the number goes up to 250,000, that's really not much of an uptick. Of course, these numbers are based on the old station on Cabarrus Street, which can't even fit the entire train. But the real benefit is the acceptance of local and regional commercial developers who have anointed the Warehouse District as the next go-to area in downtown Raleigh. More than $500 million in office, retail, and condo townhouse projects already have been announced around Union Station. That's progress. Most developers acknowledge that the investment gets parked elsewhere had it not been for the new multimodal hub. If someone refutes that statement, they are simply wrong. All they have to do is talk to economic developers in Denver, Portland, Oregon, or Sacramento, California. What will make Union Station a true front door is if we start moving our light rail project from a dream stage to reality and use the Raleigh stop as the hub for people going to universities, research parks, and the airport. For a growing city, any new money on transportation infrastructure is going in the right direction. We cannot build enough roads to keep up with this flow of in-migration. In the past 3 years, the U-Haul company came out with a study ranking North Carolina 7th nationally in terms of one-way U-Haul truck activity, and the Triangle area is one of the top destinations. That same day, Zillow came out with a report showing Raleigh as the second hottest market for real estate in 2018, trailing only San Jose, Seattle, Charlotte, and San Francisco rounded up the top five markets. Union Station is a good start for Raleigh, but in order for this project to be coined a front door to the city, we need to do much more, and it starts with light rail. And our next article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. The headline, How Rail Helped Lure an 800-Job Project to Eastern North Carolina. To further fuel an 800-job project in eastern North Carolina, the North Carolina Railroad Company is investing $2.5 million to construct a rail spur in Edgecombe County. NCRC was among several partners named in a state announcement celebrating the $580 million investment that Chinese tire maker Triangle Tire is making in a new manufacturing operation at the Kingsborough CSX megasite. According to NCRC, it's planning to build both a rail spur and a storage track for Triangle Tire at the site, and it's one of the elements that helped attract Triangle Tire over a competing site in Georgia. Scott Saylor, NCRC president, said in a statement that projects of Triangle Tire scale require significant infrastructure like rail to meet their needs, and this is another example of North Carolina's competitiveness in attracting a large-scale manufacturer. Dan Gerlach, president of another of those collaborative partners, the Golden Leaf Foundation, says having infrastructure commitments in place gives the state a leg up in competing for major marketing projects. For major manufacturing projects. His organization committed $7 million a year ago to implement infrastructure at the Kingsborough site, he notes, and rail in particular is a big concern for manufacturers looking to potentially ship bulky products and parts to customers. The North Carolina Railroad Company has been very aggressive in recent months to help figure out ways to fund some of these things and become a partner in these ventures, Gerlach says. Taking care of these kinds of infrastructure details reduces the uncertainty for companies like Triangle Tire, he says. These collaborative partnerships are becoming an important part of our arsenal in attracting and winning these types of projects, he explains. Getting things done to reduce the uncertainty for global companies is essential because the speed of business is increasing. As far as rail goes, it's been critical in luring past projects, too. Among the biggest rail investments made to attract a company involved Spirit AeroSystems' planned 1,000-job expansion in 2008. A $24 million North Carolina Department of Transportation rail spur was part of the incentives package, thought to be critical to transport the Airbus parts Spirit was manufacturing to the port. The firm, at least as of December, had yet to actually use the spur, however, instead electing to ship massive airplane parts to the port by truck or even fly them directly via the Global Transparks runway. But site lead Terry George says the firm is constantly evaluating its options, including for rail, and while the company never quite met those initial job projections, it has made major investments in the state. Spirit AeroSystems has about 600 employees in Kinston and recently announced plans for a $55.7 million expansion at that site. Our next article, written by Ben Graham, has the headline, Office Building Hotel Could Soon Rise Next to Crabtree Mall. Developers of a six-story office building next to Crabtree Valley Mall have purchased the land they need and plan to break ground in the coming months. East-West Partners of Chapel Hill has closed on a $7 million deal for the Atlantic BT building and the underlying 2.4-acre parcel at the corner of Creedmoor Road and Glenwood Avenue. That was the first step toward getting the project started, says Lee Perry, partner at the firm. The end result will be a 175,000-square-foot Class A office building called Crabtree Terrace. It will include retail space and a parking deck with room for 610 cars. The firm's equity partner on the land purchase was Northridge Capital out of Washington, D.C. The existing three-story building dates back to the 1970s and is currently anchored by Raleigh web design firm Atlantic BT. The tenants will be out by the end of the month, Perry says, and the demolition could begin soon after. The visibility of the property and its proximity to the mall made it an attractive location, he says. We've been eyeing the Crabtree submarket for a long time, Perry says. We think it's underserved from an office standpoint. Perry wouldn't say how much the project is expected to cost. Construction is supposed to begin in the second quarter of 2018. Office and retail broker specialists from CBRE Raleigh are handling the leasing for the building. The development will complement a hotel that has been in the works for the neighboring property. Although the developer has been tight-lipped about the project, Shaman Hotels of Chester, Virginia owns the property. CEO Neil Amon previously said his company is planning an upscale hotel and conference center to the site. Amon couldn't immediately be reached for comment Tuesday. The future hotel property was once the site of a proposed 43-story tower building that would have been the tallest in Raleigh, called the Soleil Center. A group of local developers proposed building the tower in 2006 as a luxury hotel and condominium building. Starwood Hotels was planning to do the branding for the Towers Hotel under its luxury Westin brand, but construction work was halted in 2008 at the beginning of the economic recession. Shaman purchased the property at auction in 2015. Starwood's website lists a Westin Raleigh Crabtree Valley Hotel scheduled to open in 2019. East-West Partners bought the office building property from Crabtree Partners, LLC, an entity managed by Raleigh builders Mark Annis and Rod Mangrum, among others. Crossdale Farm feels Durham's growth. This is also an article by Ben Graham. The growth and rapid development taking place in Durham isn't quarantined to the city's core. David Beecher, the fourth-generation developer of Crossdale Farm, says he is seeing more suburban development just outside of town at the more than 1,000-acre residential community where he works. We're not immune to the growth that Durham's undergoing, says Beecher, who develops the farm through the firm Garden View Realty. You look downtown and it's unbelievable, and all that growth continues even in the suburb areas of Durham. The development plan for Crossdale Farm was approved in 1987, and hundreds of homes and apartments have been built on the property since then. But 2017 was exceptionally busy, Beecher says. We've had more construction going on in Crossdale Farm than we've ever had in our history, he says. Work is now underway on an $80 million expansion to the Crossdale Village Retirement Community, a project that will add more rooms, new dining facilities, and an indoor swimming pool. The community, owned by United Methodist Retirement Homes, expects to see the first phase of the project wrap up by the end of this year, and the second phase in 2019. Just around the corner, a joint venture partnership is working on a 320-unit multifamily project called Residence of the Lodge. The first units will be delivered in late March, and the entire project is expected to be complete by February 2019, says Blair Booth, a real estate investor working on the project. The joint venture partnership consists of the Davis Companies of Boston and Gemini Real Estate LLC. Gemini is also a joint venture between Capital Properties of Raleigh. Earlier in 2017, crews finished work on the 144-unit Woodstone Apartments, another project at Crossdale Farm. Next up is a large residential development with 136 single-family home and townhouses being built by Home by Dickerson. Beecher says he's had 200 people show interest in the development already, even though prices haven't been set yet. I've never had more people interested in a project ever, he says. Fuquay Varina opens room for massive growth south of town. When Fuquay Varina Mayor John Byrne voted to approve the annexation of a 213-acre property into town last year, he had more on his mind than the 490 homes that would be built there. Byrne and other town leaders were looking to prepare for future development on a vast swath of land south of the town limits. Pulte Group bought the land, an old golf course called Hidden Valley, for $5.37 million and is now installing sewer infrastructure that will support residential development at the new subdivision, but also much more development on more than 1,000 acres south of town. Fuquay Varina leaders agreed to pay $475,000 for the home building company to ramp up the sewer capacity for the project, far past what it would need for its own subdivision. It certainly makes sense not to have to redo stuff, especially infrastructure, so you plan ahead, Byrne says. This is a region that has a lot of potential to it. Instead of a pumping capacity of 225 gallons of flow per minute, the new infrastructure will allow for 900 gallons to the town's wastewater treatment plant, says Fuquay Varina town manager Adam Mitchell. The increase could allow for another estimated 1,700 homes in the surrounding area, along South Highway 55 and Purfoy Road. We know just from our current economic climate that Fuquay Varina is an area in the county that much of the residential development community and commercial development community are eyeing as a potential location to invest, Mitchell says. We want to make sure we are infrastructure ready for when those investments occur. While some other towns in Wake County are casting a skeptical eye on rapid growth, Fuquay Varina is taking another approach. The town is in the midst of a $34 million expansion to its wastewater treatment plant that will drastically increase the community's ability to expand. Byrne says it's the single largest expenditure the town has ever made. The project is expected to be complete this summer. Last year, the town also inked a deal to move its offices downtown, a move that will more than double the size of Town Hall. Town officials justified the upgrade by pointing to the municipality's explosive growth during the past three decades. In that time period, the population has exploded from 4,500 to 27,000. Despite its location in the far southern reaches of Wake County, it takes less than 30 minutes to drive to downtown Raleigh from Fuquay Varina. Pulte, a giant publicly traded home builder, moved into the area with the golf course land purchase, which took place in December. At the time, Pulte Raleigh Division President David Carrier cited the area's rapid growth rate and its proximity to Raleigh and Research Triangle Park. "We love the location. We love the accessibility," he said. And that article was written by Ben Graham. And our next article was written by John Brazier of the Triad Business Journal. The headline, UNC study says Lidl's effect on grocery prices is unprecedented. Consumers pay lower prices for staple products at U.S. grocery store retailers located near a new Lidl store, according to an independent study that was released Wednesday by the UNC Chapel Hill Kenan Flagler Business School. The study was commissioned by Lidl U.S., which opened its first stores in June, with North Carolina included in the first wave. The closest Triangle location in the initial round was in Sanford, but the grocer has at least 12 planned from the Triangle to the coast, including four in Wake County. Lidl built a $125 million regional headquarters and distribution center in Alamance County. Katrin Gielens, an associate professor of marketing at the business school who led the study, said she found that supermarkets in the vicinity of a Lidl store set their prices approximately 9.3% lower compared to their stores where Lidl is not active. She said Aldi, 13.9%, Food Lion, 13.6%, and Kroger, 10.1%, were found to cut their prices significantly in markets with Lidl stores. Little or no effect was shown at Publix or Walmart stores. With about 90% of Lidl products private label, Gillen said Lidl prices were compared only to competitors' private label products' shelf prices. Gielens spoke to media on a teleconference Wednesday afternoon. "The level of competitive pressure Lidl is exerting on leading retailers to drop their prices in these markets is unprecedented," Gielens said. "In fact, the competitive price-cutting effect of Lidl's entry in a market is more than three times stronger than the effect of Walmart's entry in a new market, reported by previous academic work." Gielens analyzed prices in six markets where Lidl operates and six identical twin markets where its stores are not present in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Gielen surveyed prices for 48 grocery products, including dairy, meats, produce, and canned and frozen goods collected through store visits. The highest effect was found on milk prices, which averaged 56% higher in non-Lidl markets. She said she didn't expect Lidl to raise its prices significantly as it becomes more familiar to U.S. customers. "Based on my observations, I don't think that's likely to happen," Gielen said. "I think they're in it for the long run, so the pressure on competitors will remain the same. They do not have to react to every quarterly report. They are privately owned, and they can afford to sweat it out for quite a bit." As no-frills grocers such as Aldi, Lidl, and Walmart have gained in the grocery market in recent years, Gielen said the attitude of American shoppers has changed. "Cheap is the new smart," she said. "I think people don't want to be ripped off by a brand name." Lidl has made some adjustments since expanding into the U.S. The company scaled back its original plans in Georgia, especially in Metro Atlanta. Triangle housing supply is low, but the number of real estate agents is up. As the demand for houses in the Triangle continues at a seemingly insatiable rate, the number of licensed real estate agents has ballooned as well and now is well above pre-recession totals. The Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors had 7,742 licensed members in 2017. In 2007, the trade group had 6,999 members. Membership hit its nadir in 2012 at the depths of the recession but has climbed since then. Beginning in 2016, there were more people selling homes than before the economic downturn. "Some of that is new licenses, people getting into the business for the first time," says Tessa Holtz, the Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors CEO. Others are people who may have let their licenses lapse during the depths of the recession but have since renewed them, she says. Around the triangle, people in the home building and selling businesses often talk about how the industry isn't as rosy as it often appears in the headlines. Demand is way up, as are prices, and that may lead more people to take the plunge into real estate business. But that doesn't necessarily mean business is booming for everyone. Inventory is exceptionally low. For most of 2017, counties throughout the triangle had less than 3 months of home inventory on the market. Real estate experts say that 6 months of supply is market equilibrium. There's a lot of buyers out looking for homes, but there's not a lot to sell, says Linda Kraft of Kraft Residential. That can make it difficult for new and old agents alike. It's a very hard time in the business, and that's not going to change anytime soon because they just can't crank out enough properties with the demand we have, Kraft says. Across the country, the National Association of Realtors has seen an increase in interest, with membership rising from 1.16 million in March 2016 to 1.22 million the following year, according to the organization's 2017 member profile. Of the agents with less than 2 years of experience, more than half made $10,000 or less. And that article was written by Ben Graham. This next article is written by Eric Spanberg of the Charlotte Business Journal. NC Governor open to options to keep NFL in Charlotte. Governor Roy Cooper told Charlotte Business Journal on Friday he has already begun talks with business leaders to ensure the upcoming sale of the Carolina Panthers doesn't affect the team's commitment to Charlotte. Cooper, a Democrat, said he is open to options that could include state assistance to keep the NFL franchise in the state for the long term. The Panthers are going to be put up for sale as soon as the team plays its last game of the season. That could be as soon as this weekend. Carolina plays the Saints in New Orleans on Sunday afternoon in a wild card round playoff game in which the Saints won. Team founder Jerry Richardson disclosed plans on December 17 to sell the Panthers, hours after Sports Illustrated published an article alleging financial settlements stemming from sexual and racial harassment of four former employees by Richardson. The NFL has begun an independent investigation of Richardson. The Carolina Panthers are critical to the Charlotte area and North Carolina's economy, Cooper told me Friday during a visit to a Charlotte area elementary school, where he discussed concerns over funding state-mandated class sizes. I want them to stay here. I don't see any reason that a change in ownership would cause the Panthers or the NFL to want this great team to move. Last month, after Richardson said he would sell the Panthers, an NFL spokesman told reporters on a media conference call that the league expects the team to stay in Charlotte. Richardson and his investors paid $206 million in 1993 for the expansion club that became the Panthers. 2 years later, the team began playing. Richardson, an 81-year-old former NFL player who made his fortune in the restaurant business, hasn't discussed the allegations publicly. According to Forbes, the Panthers are worth $2.3 billion. The NFL team has played in two Super Bowls and has sold out all but two home games since 74,000-seat Bank of America Stadium opened in Uptown Charlotte in 1996. Richardson and the Panthers own the stadium, which, by NFL standards, is an aging facility. Fans and civic leaders have openly wondered whether the next owner will want a new stadium sooner rather than later and how much government funding would be needed. New NFL venues now routinely cost $1 billion and up. Cooper said it's too soon to tell what the next Panthers owners will want. But what I have done is begun the process of consulting with local leaders here and those in the business community to talk about ways that the state can help, he said. I think the Carolina Panthers are a valuable asset that recognizes the value of being right here. We're one of the fastest growing areas in the state. It's an amazing market. The fans are great. This area sells itself. I cannot imagine any owner that would buy this team who would want to move it because this is a great place to be. This week, the Panthers confirmed the hiring of New York investment bank Allen & Company to lead the sale. Proskauer, Rose, and Moore and Van Allen will provide legal advice. Republican leaders in the General Assembly, House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger, could not be reached for immediate comment Friday on whether they support possible state funding or incentives to keep the Panthers in Charlotte. I obviously want them to be here, and I'm open to options that local leaders and business leaders would have as we go forward, Cooper said. We don't know enough about this to be making any specific proposals. What the Carolina Panthers and their fans need to know is that North Carolina wants them, and we don't want them to go anywhere. And I don't think they will. We want to talk to them about ways that we can help. When asked whether state funding to help pay for a stadium is an inevitable request, the governor said, "We don't know that that's the case. I believe that this team will want to stay in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we certainly need to let them know that we want them to stay. But I think most every public official would tell you that the Carolina Panthers are good for our economy." Charlotte businessman Felix Sabates, a minority owner of the NBA Charlotte Hornets, is part of a local group preparing to bid for the Panthers. He told CBJ this week, "The NFL team will need a new domed stadium to generate enough revenue to justify the anticipated sales price and to attract tourism-friendly events such as the Super Bowl, NCAA Men's Final Four, and major concerts." In 2013, state lawmakers rebuffed proposals by the Panthers and local government to approve a $300 million stadium renovation and related projects that would have committed the NFL team to stay in Charlotte for 15 more seasons. Instead, the city ultimately settled for a 6-year hard tether, binding the team to Bank of America Stadium through 2019 in exchange for $75 million in tourism tax money. That public money has helped the team add escalators to the upper level and replace the scoreboards and sound system as part of a $77 million makeover. The team invested $102 million, far above its required minimum of $35 million. Then-Speaker Tom Tillis, a Charlotte-area Republican who is now a U.S. Senator, told CBJ in the fall of 2012 that he was open to the idea of using some state money to help the Panthers. Later, though, Tillis and the rest of the political leaders in Raleigh opted against helping the team despite personal lobbying in the Capitol by Richardson. Now we'll turn to the Executive Voice article written by Lauren K. Onasorge. And the headline on this one, "Diversity helps spark turnaround at key Lenovo division." Kirk Scoggin, who leads Lenovo's data center group, says it's not just about writing the server unit the Chinese company acquired from IBM. He is also trying to empower a diverse team of entrepreneurs, and to do it, he's putting a major focus on getting women in leadership positions. In a candid conversation, Scoggin says Lenovo's gender diversity push is paying off. Part of it is through new hires, such as that of former Intel colleague Kim Stevenson, the new senior vice president and general manager of data center infrastructure. He's also promoting workplace policies that promote flexibility. Scoggin, who joined the company last year from Intel, says that in order to promote women in technology, companies, Lenovo included, have to figure out ways to break down barriers. At Lenovo, where the culture is such that he can put his 3- and 10-year-old first, flexibility is key. And he says the outside world is starting to recognize Lenovo's efforts. Last year, Lenovo was named among the 2017 Working Mother 100 Best Companies alongside firms such as Johnson & Johnson and Bank of America. The honor recognized its flexibility, child care, and paid parental leave policy. Laura Latrello, a vice president in the Scoggin-led data center group, was singled out as Lenovo's Working Mother of the Year. The recognition, coupled with the fact that 54% of Lenovo's female employees in the United States are working mothers, validates that the push is working, he says. In the meantime, his team is working to right the numbers. In November, his group reported a revenue increase of 10% year over year in North America, characterized in an earnings release as solid. Scoggin says he's optimistic that the traction will accelerate in 2018 and that he has the full support of CEO Yangwen Yang, who offers him a great deal of autonomy. Scoggin joined the team more than a year ago, tasked with writing the unit acquired from IBM, and Scoggin says there's real evidence of Lenovo's transformation in recent months. A big part of that has been a shift in the sales strategy. Lenovo reversed an earlier management decision that had combined a lot of its sales units and channel partners together for efficiency. What happened is people spent more of their time on the PC side, he says. So back in January of 2017, we split back off. We went back to a 100% dedicated sales force and a whole new set of channel partners. Scoggin estimates the previous policy held the company back for a year. But now we're a year back into it, and we see our indicators going back in the right direction, he says. Part of that transformation has involved reeling in some of its remote workers and making job cuts in 2017. We did give some tough messages this past year, he notes, explaining that many remote managers were given the choice to either come to the office or seek other employment opportunities. But it has paid off, he says, noting, we believe that the right leaders and management are on site here with folks. Overall, his team is hiring in the Triangle. As we grow and as our financials continue to improve, we'll grow talent as well, he says. Overall, Scoggin says he can't get enough of his new role or the new community he calls home. I think it's amazing when you move in how passionate people are on different areas to live, whether it's inside the Beltline or North Hills or Chapel Hill or Durham or Cary, he says. Scoggin picked Cary, going from the hour commute he would have had in Silicon Valley to a 9-minute commute. I get to live on a golf course, he says. What's bad about that? And despite a heavy travel schedule, he has more time to spend with his family and watch how they interact with the technology his company is developing. They're already talking to their Lenovo smart speaker to ask about their homework. Even when Dad's in the kitchen, he laughs. It's an indicator, he says, of what's coming as new generations acclimate to innovation. The way we interact with computers is changing, he says. My kids have no issue talking to their computer and getting their homework help. Imagine what's coming next. And our next article is written by John Downey of the Charlotte Business Journal. The headline, Arctic Blast Sends Natural Gas Prices to New Record in North Carolina. The Southeast's recent Arctic blast drove natural gas prices up to a record $175 per decatherm in North Carolina and Virginia, from average rates around $3 per decatherm. That's left Duke Energy Group and Dominion Energy Incorporated arguing the late December to early January cold snap demonstrates the need for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Duke spokeswoman Tammy McGee says prices did not spike because of a shortage of natural gas. There is plenty of natural gas available, she says. Prices dramatically increased during the past week because of a transportation shortage. The high price reached at the end of last week shattered the $125 per decatherm record set during the polar vortex in 2014. That price is based on regional costs for natural gas deliveries in an area that covers southern Maryland into parts of South Carolina. Disputed claim. Environmental groups and other project opponents dispute the need for the $5.5 billion pipeline, which would transport gas from West Virginia almost to the coast of Virginia and then south past Lumberton, North Carolina. Kate Adelson, director of the Sierra Club's Virginia chapter, says there's no evidence the pipeline is necessary for adequate gas supplies or for gas to produce electricity. Operators are prepared for events like these and have been preparing since the last polar vortex, she says. Study after study and expert after expert have strongly contended our grid is reliable and stable, especially with the increasing diversification of generation sources because of the addition of solar, wind, and energy efficiency in the past decade. The Sierra Club is one of six groups that together filed a new legal challenge to the pipeline on Monday. That filing with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Washington, D.C. Circuit again raises their contention there is no evidence the pipeline is needed. We must hold the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission accountable for failing to evaluate the need for this project in a rational manner, says Peter Anderson, the Virginia Program Manager for Appalachian Voices. Service interrupted. But Duke and Dominion claim the evidence is clear in the wake of the recent extreme weather. Dominion spokesman Aaron Ruby cites the huge spike in prices and says that Virginia Natural Gas was forced last week to interrupt gas service to 11 industrial customers who had agreed to contracts for interruptible service. One customer had deliveries curtailed for 4 days, he says. We've said for a long time that the pipelines serving our region are stretched too thin and cannot handle the coldest winter days, he says. Our economy isn't going to grow if we have to curtail our industries whenever it gets cold or if consumer prices skyrocket when our pipelines are overstrained. Piedmont Natural Gas, a subsidiary of Duke, says it has also had to curtail service for a small number of industrial customers. McGee points to Duke's own experience during the coldest weather. Duke paid an average of $40 per decatherm for gas to operate its natural gas plants from January 1 through January 8. The highest price day saw charges of $120 per decatherm. Duke, as a very large customer, is able to get gas at better prices than some other industrial buyers. Appalachian Gas. McGee says that is because the entire state is dependent on the Transco pipeline, the only interstate pipeline that runs into North Carolina. With all the state's gas left to that single source coming from the Gulf of Mexico, supply was scarce and prices were high, she says. Natural gas from the Appalachian region, essentially the Marcellus and Utica shale fields that would be the ACP's source, was averaging just $3.70 per decatherm that same week. Virginia is served by more than one interstate pipeline, but Transco, or interstate lines linked to it, account for more than 75% of the gas in the state. Ruby says Dominion has faced a situation similar to Duke's. And some customers will ultimately pay the price for the spikes, he says. The price of natural gas is a pass-through cost for electric and gas utilities in North Carolina and Virginia. That means they cannot make a profit on the price of the gas, but the cost is passed directly on to users. Some protected. Piedmont spokeswoman Lori Elswick says the residential gas customers are protected from such price spikes because the utility contracts for residential service a year at a time. Prices for residential customers are already fixed. Gas utilities like Piedmont and PSNC Energy can change charges from month to month to account for swings in the price they pay for the fuel. Electric utilities, which have had to pay higher prices for natural gas during the extreme cold, generally can change the fuel charge only at specific intervals in the two states. But the price spike will impact their customer bills. And some natural gas customers also face hikes. In North Carolina, Rocky Mount Public Utilities has already informed its customers the charge to recoup the increased cost of gas will raise the average January bill for a typical customer to $151.83, up from $121.83. The increase will remain in place throughout the winter months, the utility warned its customers in a press release Monday. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.